Creative Male Aging, a radio and internet project in which we're exploring and challenging many of the conventions around aging and looking particularly at new options for today's older men. I'm Tony Ryan. Welcome to the program.
Our demography is changing. Young workers are not going to be available in the numbers that they were in the past. And if that's going to be your only policy to recruit young workers, you're going to be recruiting from a diminishing labour pool. And there are, I think, significant advantages to having a balance of younger and older workers in the workforce so that there is that passing on of experience and knowledge and culture, which is really important because the perspective which older workers bring into the workplace, I think, is very important. They're very important in creating a really sound, sharing, effective working situation.
In our program today, we're asking questions such as, what do we know about older men in the workforce? What are the benefits of having older men in an organisation? What are employer expectations of the older men who work for them, men maybe in their 50s, 60s and even beyond? How do older men cope with change in the workplace? And what is known about hidden unemployment and the effects on men in this situation, personally and for their families and communities? Professor Graham Hugo is Professorial Fellow in the Department of Geographical and Environmental Studies at the University of Adelaide. One of his extensive areas of study has been on Australian population issues and problems. Recently, I spoke with Professor Hugo in his office at the University of Adelaide about older men in the workforce. Professor Graham Hugo, thank you very much for doing this interview with me. What is known about older men in the workforce today?
Traditionally, Australians, when I say traditionally, going back before World War II, men remained in the workforce for a very long period of time. I remember my own grandfather, I think, retired quite in his late 70s. And of course, that was a time where there weren't the provisions for pensions and so on, which were available to only a very narrow group in the community. But when in the post-war period, when we had the introduction of the universal pension and so on, there was quite a plummeting in the rate of workforce participation. And there was a lot of stereotyping about that, of it being men who wanted lifestyle advantages of retiring to the coast and taking it easy, and it was all very lifestyle-led and everything. But the reality of it was that most of it is forced, and still is, that there are health issues involved, there are redundancy issues, there's the biases among some employers about older men in the workforce, a whole range of reasons for people being pushed out rather than them opting to leave the workforce. Now, it's pulled back a little bit with greater participation levels in older ages, which has been partly, I think, associated with people realising that with the fact that we now live longer, that they're going to have to make bigger provision for older age. But nevertheless, there still remains this significant attrition, which is not lifestyle driven, but which is forced. And whether it be health issues, which are often quite considerable, and whether it be redundancies, they're very significant in that while there is an increase in the participation levels, all the older men who want to be working aren't working. And I think that does remain a very, very significant issue, and one which is, I think, too often put down to lifestyle factors rather than people being pushed out of the workforce in their older years.
Professor Hugo, we're all aware that men and women live longer than, say, 100 years ago. What are the consequences of increased longevity in the context of the working lives of men?
Yeah, one of the things that I think is really important in looking at these sorts of issues today is that recently I worked out the life expectancy of an Australian male age 50 in 1970 and today. And the fact is a male in Australia turning 50 today can expect to live 9 more years than an Australian male turning 50 in 1970. Now, that's a massive change. 9 extra years of life per average Australian male compared with just 40 years ago. Now, it only makes sense that a significant part of that should be in the workforce, I think. Now, workforce most broadly defined, whether it be voluntary, whether it be in the paid workforce, whether it be part-time or fractional time or full-time, that's all part of it, I think. But, you know, we are in a different world today compared to what we were 40, 50 years ago in terms of life expectancy. And I really don't think our institutions, our employers have really caught up with this, that we aren't going to have a big supply of young workers. And the reality is that they're going to be forced to have older workers. And what that means is making the adjustments within our workplaces, within our attitudes, and whether the balance between full-time and part-time and fractional time, all of these sorts of issues, I think, have to be taken on board in much the way we did when women came into the workforce more. But I think we have to have a whole new look at older men and older women as well in the workforce, and partly from the perspective that it's good for the economy. I mean, there's no doubt about that. With us living longer, if we work longer as well, we can offset some of those costs. But you know, every piece of evidence shows that men are better off for it if they are able to participate in some effective way, whether it be through the voluntary or the paid workforce.
Let's stay with the paid workforce just for the moment. What are the benefits to an organisation of having older workers?
Yes, so I think we often hear of the benefits of younger people in that they've grown up in the computer age, and I think there's absolutely no doubt about that, having to get my kids to do all my electronic things that need to be fixed. But the reality is that there are real myths about older workers, and older workers are as variant and diverse as younger workers. There's no we get into stereotypes about productivity, about you know, lack of ability to change and things like that. The reality is they're just as different in their characteristics as younger workers. There are some things which are different, and you know, health is obviously one of them. And there may well need to be modifications in the workplace to take account of that. But I think, you know, one of the things that I think people are really starting to increasingly appreciate is the value of experience. I think we went through a phase where in managerialism where people were assigned a particular set of skills which they have, and everybody is like a building block that you just take one away and they can be replaced. And what's being found more and more is that institutional history and knowledge of ways of doing things over a long period of time, that fund of experience, but also an ability to put things in perspective. There's a whole range of things which older workers do have more than younger people, purely because they've been around a lot longer, they've dealt with different systems. And you know, to me, the ideal workforce is having that real balance between older and younger workers. It's not one or the other. It should be both. And as I said before, the demography of the situation means that employers are going to be forced into this situation. There is not going to be an alternative other than to increase the number of older workers that they have. And I think, you know, we have to break down some of those prejudices, just as we had to break them down about women workers, just as we're having to break them down today about workers from third world countries in Australia.
I think there are a number of myths around about how older men cope with change in the workplace. You know, are they flexible? Can they cope with change and so on? What is the research telling us about that?
Yep, there is some truth to that. There's no doubt about that. But it, you know, in terms of change, and I think one good example of it is some work we've done recently in older people. Acceptance or non-acceptance of the computer and using the computer for Skype and all these types of things. And what we've found is there's a certain amount of fear about using these things. But the reality is it boils down to motivation and the way in which it's approached. You know, we recently did some work with farmers out in the Mallee, and a big reluctance to get into it at all until we demonstrated that they could Skype their grandchild across in London and look at them face to face and talk to them. All of a sudden, the skills were developed straight away. And And I think it may well be that we have to go about it in slightly different ways, but you know, I don't have any fear that older people aren't as able to change and to adopt new ways of doing things than younger people. I think it's more a matter of the way in which we motivate them, more a way in which we go about teaching them, and it might be quite different to the way we do it with younger people.
Earlier this year, Dr. Martin O'Brien in the School of Economics at the University of Wollongong wrote about what he termed hidden unemployment and the older male worker. What might be meant by that term, hidden unemployment?
Very much so. What he means by that term, I would think, is the very large number of older men who are on disability pensions or are on living off their own savings or living off superannuation and so on, who I guess are retired in inverted commas, but really they're unemployed. Their preference would be to be out in the workforce. And the difference between the actual number employed and the people who want to be employed and who are available really should be what we're looking at. But the actual unemployment figures do tend to exclude these people who partly have given up or partly they don't have an alternative but to go onto some form of disability pension or some form of superannuation. And this is, I haven't read the article, but it would seem to me that this is a huge issue really does need to be looked at, particularly in a situation where there are real pressures on the disability support system and where there are people that are, not only are able to work, are very keen to work. They should be really given the opportunity. I think one of the problems is that I don't think we're flexible enough with our older workforce. And by that I mean there still is a tendency that it's expected that people get their training in their teens and 20s, and that's got to last them right through to the end of when they retire. And the reality is that the economy is changing massively in structure. The types of jobs which we do now are different to what they were in the past. And I think we do have to come to grips with the fact that for most people, there will be a significant amount of retraining and redirecting in their careers somewhere along the line. And in Australia, we have this total bias in our training towards young people, whereas, in fact, if we want our older population to be able to move on, it's got to be associated with retraining and making available opportunities for older people to improve their skills or even make a significant career change for the last 10 years or so of their working careers.
If a man is unemployed or out of work or part of this hidden unemployed group, it has effects not only on himself but on his family and on the community, I guess.
Yes, it's a negative right across the board. I mean, the negatives in terms of personal esteem, while, you know, we can say, look, it shouldn't be taken personally, or in fact, Australian men, particularly of the older generation, I think do have real ways of visualising their own masculinity, and the breadwinner model is still strong in their own minds. The responsibility of being a father, the responsibility of being a husband, those things weigh very heavily on that generation, much more so than younger generations. And so the emotional impacts, and you know, we know the through the work of Beyond Blue and so on, the enormously high rates of depression in that transitional stage in the latter years of working. So it's profoundly negative in terms of personal effects, and that's got to rub off into the family, family interactions, and I guess the other side of it is that the community loses, because there's that bunch of talent there, talent experience, which is gold really, which isn't being used to the benefit of the community. It's just going to waste. So everybody loses out of it, and what we need though is policies which harnesses it and recognises it, so that we do still have very significant increases in demand for workers. You know, people point to high levels of unemployment and so on, but there are still niches in our economy where there is massive demand for workers. And just one that I'm aware of is the aged care area. Now, why isn't it that someone who is displaced as a car worker in their 50s in Adelaide, why can't they spend 10 or 15 years in the aged care industry? You might say, OK, they're very different skills and everything, but with retraining, with the to me, this is an example of a part of the economy which is expanding very rapidly, part of the economy which is contracting. It's mainly a male workforce. We should be able to devise those transitions which allow the men who are displaced to transition into an occupation which is going to be sustainable for them for 10 or 15 years and their final years within the workforce. But at the moment, we don't have those pathways available to people, and I think it's very important that we start creating them in a very explicit way.
On the Community Radio Network around Australia, you're listening to the second program in a series of 12 in which we challenge the stereotypes and explore new options for today's older men. Today, our focus is on men in their 40s, 50s and 60s who are still in the workforce or who may really want to be employed but can't find work following, say, a redundancy. My guest is Professor Graham Hugo from the Department of Geographical and Environmental Studies at the University of Adelaide. When men approach retirement, even say 10 years out, what could they be doing to help with that transition in their work?
That touches to me on a really big issue. In Australia, we have this very strong pattern of men working full bore at their highest level that they've ever achieved on Friday and being retired and doing nothing on Monday. Now, this is nuts. This really doesn't make sense. What we should be talking about is transitioning, and there's no reason why the transition from peak of workforce performance to retirement shouldn't take a decade. It shouldn't take certainly a number of years, and it can involve a reduction in the pressure of duties which they have. Yet, you know, our superannuation schemes often are based on your last income. So there's no way in the world that you would take a lessening of the job that you do because that's going to reduce your income all through retirement. So, you know, we're looking at our systems and saying, how do we facilitate this transition which allows people to move to a less demanding part of the workplace that they're currently in? How can they do less hours? How can that change? And at the same time, they preserve their entitlements and are able to do it in a reasonable way. So it's not just a matter of saying, OK, we're going to allow more transitioning to retirement. We have to look at our industrial system. We have to look at superannuation. We have to look at a whole range of things and the workplace organisation to be able to facilitate that. But we should be doing that because, there are just so many negative aspects of the current situation that just have to be addressed by a holistic approach to looking at the situation.
And that, in fact, brings us back to the role of the employer and their attitudes to older people and, in this case, older men in the workforce.
Yeah, very important point. And of course, one can't stereotype, one can't paint all employers with the same brush, because I've seen some magnificent examples of employers who are not just neutral in the way in which they deal with workers, but actually go out of their way to have conditions in the workplace which are specially designed to cope with older workers. And an education process with employers is crucial. Just as there was with women in coming into the workforce, just as there was with migrants and so on. In the post-war period, it's been a young person's Australia and a young man's Australia. The opportunities have been there for young people, and particularly the baby boom, where they were breaking new ground. There are all sorts of opportunities, but the concept of a progressive, high-quality worker was a young person, and that's set in the mind of the employer. And it's a matter, I think, of more education and discussion. And I think there's a role here for peak employer groups. Too often, The peak employer groups are involved in these negotiations about unions and costs and government regulation and things like this. Our demography is changing. Young workers are not going to be available in the numbers that they were in the past. And if that's going to be your only policy to recruit young workers, you're going to be recruiting from a diminishing labour pool. And there are, I think, significant advantages to having a balance of younger and older workers in the workforce so that there is that passing on of experience and knowledge and culture, which is really important, because the perspective which older workers bring into the workplace, I think, is very important. They're very important in creating a really sound, sharing, effective working situation. So getting the employers to see the advantages of an older working group, but also recognising that there may have to be some modifications to the way in which you organise the workforce, the way in which you arrange the workplace and so on, is important as well. But it's education, I think, more than anything.
We hear talk these days from government about raising the retirement age to 70. For men, what would be the implication of that?
I said earlier that there has been this massive change in life expectancy. You know, everyone talks about the increase in life expectancy at age zero, but the reality is the big change has come in the older years. Older people live longer. Now, an inevitable corollary of that, I believe, is that people should have the opportunity to work longer as well. I mean, it just makes sense for the economy and the society as a whole and for the individuals as well. But there is a real simplisticness about this whole suggestion that we just whack up the age at which people can get the pension and it'll all work out. Because the reality is that there is no one size fits all of the ideal time at which people retire. If you're a sedentary university professor like me, no one much notices if you work on beyond age 65. Whereas one of my friends, a bricklayer, he is not going to be able to work on in the way he's worked in the past much beyond 60 because of the very heavy workload that's involved. Now, to have the same sets of conditions for all workers, to me, is totally unfair and will lead to all sorts of inequities. So we really do have to have a system which is flexible, in which it takes into account the different health levels and abilities of individuals, but also what type of work they actually do. And if we're going to have 70 as a retirement age, we have to have the ability for people to change careers into things which are more age appropriate and they're able to do. We have to have retraining. We have to have a whole range of things. It's not just a matter of increasing the age. We have to put in place all of these other elements which are going to facilitate it and also take account of those people who work in physical situations where they can't work to older ages. Mm.
And that leads me to think about the possible role of mentoring, men taking on a different role within the organisation.
I think that is a very important point, that one of the real things which an older generation of workers can pass on to others in the workforce is their experience, their advice, ways of doing things. And mentoring clearly is the key process in that. And I believe quite strongly that in the past, where we've had a more relaxed approach to living. I know in working at the university, we used to stop for morning tea, where everyone would sit down. If you're working on a building site, you'd stop for a smoko and people would sit down, and there'd be this, not just a social occasion, but it'd be a time for passing on all of those bits and pieces of the culture of a job, the culture of the workplace, the ways of doing things. That used to happen in a seamless way. It doesn't happen anymore because everyone's so frenetic. They don't have those opportunities to have those non-mainstream work-related things discussed. So what you need is a structured, formal process of mentoring. And that's something that, you know, certainly would be part of having older men in the workplace and able to, not just able to pass on these things, but having real channels through which they could pass on their wisdom to younger generations.
Professor Graham Hugo, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today, but let me end with this one question. What to you would make a good retirement for a man?
Well, when I think about this question, I think about my own father and my grandfather. My grandfather was forced to work long, way into his 70s, and when he retired, it basically was a move into poverty because they didn't have available the whole range of support systems which are available today. But with my own father, who was a shift worker, and then worked in the office part of the factory where he spent his whole life, he only had one employer. He and my mother probably didn't see very much of each other, bringing up the children, him working shift work, all of those types of things. And their retirement was wonderful, and I don't have any hesitation in saying that. And I think the things that made it wonderful was that it was for the first time in their life they've worked so hard that they really luxuriated in the relaxed pace of doing a few things together and so on. So, you know, I think a good retirement is having people around you that you really care about, and in my father's case his wife, but also his children and grandchildren. I think that family context is a crucial part of a retirement. Another element is being engaged, and that engagement in my father's case was not once he retired from full-time work. It wasn't paid work, but it was volunteer work with a number of organisations and societies at his pace, where his skills were appreciated. He got satisfaction out of doing things, but at his pace with the skills that he particularly had. And so that degree of activity, I think, is an important part of a good retirement for most people. The community, I think, having, you know, living within a community which he felt comfortable and had social contacts, to me that's also very much part of it. Health is, you know, something we tend to perhaps not take account of as much as we should, because that, to me, is a very important element. And the other one was, in his case, the pension and the gold card he got from being a returned soldier. Those things which take the edge off economic hardship, which so many old people experience, that to me is part of a good retirement as well. So I'd say they're the ingredients that I'd see as being a good retirement.
Today in Creative Male Ageing, I've been speaking with Professor Graham Hugo, Professorial Fellow in the Department of Geographical and Environmental Studies at the University of Adelaide. This project was made possible with assistance from the Office for the Ageing, Department of Health, the Government of South Australia. From PBAFM in Adelaide, I'm Tony Ryan. Till next time, go well.